history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, brought to you by Paul Everett's RV Country, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some seemingly ordinary Americans around you with extraordinary stories to tell. And we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we don't forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The gentleman you're going to meet today has quite a story to tell. He was one of the first Americans to walk through the gates of a concentration camp in Europe during World War II, and there's a lot more to his story than that. And I want to go way, way back with Ralph Rush. You were one of seven brothers to serve in World War II, but before that, you're born in Nebraska, grow up for a while in Indiana, and then you come to Hollywood.
Yeah.
Before Hollywood was what it is today, what was Hollywood like when you got there in the 30s?
I can remember my dad having a terrible time learning how to drive in Hollywood traffic. And first thing he knows, he's out looking for a job and somebody runs into him and it's Mickey Rooney. His only excuse was he says, sorry, sir, I see that blonde that's walking over there. He says, she's got the most beautiful legs. I was watching her and I couldn't see you at all. So he says, I apologize to you. Never did pay the bill, but he apologized to him for running into him.
And it probably wasn't that unusual in the Hollywood of that day to run into a few of the stars here and there.
No, that was quite common. We lived right by the Hollywood Hills where the letters were, Hollywood, and they used to climb up there and so on. So we got to see the folks, and right down below was the theater that they used to do their hands in the cement and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, the Chinese theater is still there.
Chinese theater, yeah.
And with such a big family during the Great Depression, did you have a sense for how difficult things were, or were you oblivious to it because you were so young?
No, we were pretty aware of it because we were such a large family, eight kids, and we'd had to trade shoes, and we were aware it was tough time. It was in the 30s, and it was so tough that we got flooded out, and my dad said, the hell with this, and he piled as many as he would get in a car and headed for California, and that's when we got to Hollywood.
I know it was a long time ago. Do you remember having some dreams, some ambitions, some, hey, when I grow up someday, this is what I'm going to do?
Yeah, I think I probably did, and we were a farming family, and it was something that I enjoyed, and I actually followed that in most of my education in the agriculture area.
Did you ever think you were going to end up growing Christmas trees for a living?
No, didn't ever expect to do that. But I had a buddy. He and I started Christmas tree farms in various places. Ended up doing them on the campus of Stanford. Stanford has a heck of a lot of land and easy access to it.
And they've called Stanford the farm forever, but I don't think a lot of people realize you actually had a farm on the farm.
A nice farm, a farm where you cut, and we did thousands of trees. Monterey pines. Monterey pines are adaptable into a lot of things, and people didn't realize that you could make Christmas trees out of them. We learned how to do it, and we did it. Stanford decided we were making too much money, so they doubled our cost of working there, and we just couldn't make enough money from them to make it worthwhile, so we had to tell them to go eat their trees.
Well, they have one for their mascot still, so I guess that works.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Well, and the reason I brought it up is because I understand a Christmas tree has something to do with what you were doing on December 7th, 1941, when you found out about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
Right. We had our girlfriends with us, and we went out looking for a Christmas tree. And I joined the Army Air Corps, I think they called it at the time.
Why'd you do that?
I thought flying would be a way to go and not be walking on my feet as much as I had in the past. They took me in. I went to Luke Airfield in Arizona and started out as loading ammunition on planes. got sort of tired of that, and they had a chance that I could do some photography. It was a hobby of mine.
This is developing aerial photographs or what?
Well, all kinds.
Okay.
And I couldn't quite get along too well with the guy that was head honcho in the office there. So an opportunity came up to go to a place down near the border of California and Arizona. I went down there and was running the photo operation for them. They were teaching the guys that are flyers how to shoot down airplanes. You get guys fly an airplane, but shooting down another airplane is a pretty tough job. Mm-hmm. So you've got to learn how to do it. I was developing the film from the wing guns. It required all kinds of crazy things to do. I took care of the boys so that their girlfriends got their pictures and all that kind of stuff. And then I ran the theater. When the guys had come in, they had to come in on the wing and they'd shoot at the targets that we had to set up. And then the film had to be developed. So the film had to go back to Luke Field, be developed. And it was a long time. The guys would be shooting and not know how well they did until that film came back. So I had some friends in Hollywood from my past experience there. And I called up a chap who was actually one that made one of the famous films. I said, I need a quick method of developing 35-millimeter film so our guys don't have to stand around or wait around for a week. And they flew me up to Hollywood, and we spent about 3 weeks. And we developed a machine that, with the help of some of their technical people, and we got so we could develop the film in about 2 hours. So that machine did great job for helping our guys learn how to shoot.
And time was such an important element of all of that.
Yes, it was.
So we've heard about all the different Hollywood stars who went over and served. I mean, Jimmy Stewart was flying bombing missions. So many guys were doing USO tours. Other guys were in just about every branch of service. But you give us another example of how Hollywood helped the war effort.
Yes, they did. But we were so shorthanded that we had to double up on different projects, and they stuck me in the back seat of the plane. They were the AT-6s. That's sort of an interesting, you're going backwards, you're sitting backwards in it, and the pilot's piloting the plane, and you hope that guys that are shooting at the target are shooting at the right target, not you. We'd always check the tail to see how many holes are in it to tell us how close the guys were getting.
Because you were towing a sleeve that they're supposed to be shooting at?
Yeah, we were pulling the sleeve, and it was out quite a ways.
But there were some times you found holes in the tail?
Oh, yeah, holes in the tail and holes in the body of the plane.
So you got sick of getting shot at? That's why you went into the ASTP program, or what?
No, I had a buddy in headquarters at Luke Field. He called me and said, Ralph, how'd you like to go back to college? And I said, sounds good to me. I've been shot at enough as it is. I wouldn't mind going back. A lot of people are not aware of the fact that we were in a war, and we had a lot of work to catch up with Germany from the standpoint of how well our guys were trained and so forth. So they went through the college ranks that were in Luke Field and other places, had to pass a bunch of tests, and if you passed, well, then they grabbed a hold of you and sent you off to places where they were training people to be engineers or doctors and other elements that we were short of in general,
right,
in the American Army. And they put me in an engineering program and shipped me up with a bunch of other guys to Oregon State College. ASTP was the name of the program. Yeah.
Army Specialized Training Program.
Right. There were thousands brought in from the various colleges that had some connection with military training.
So you're thinking, okay, I'm coming up here to Corvallis, and I'll just go to college for the rest of the war.
Right.
But that's not how it worked out with that program.
Didn't quite work out that way, no. We were doing a great job, though. We were top-notch when it came to quality of training. All the schools that were involved in this program did well, but the government decided, well, we're wasting our money up there or something.
Well, they needed some bodies in Europe too, didn't they?
Yeah, they did. So they yanked us all out and sent us off to different places, and I was sent off to Germany.
So here you'd been in the Army Air Corps because you wanted to avoid fighting on the ground.
Yeah.
Then you get a chance to go to college, which is even better.
Yeah, right.
But now they take you out of college and say, hey, you're in the infantry now. Surprise, surprise.
Yes.
How'd you feel about that?
Well, was a little disappointing because we had some good programs planned up there, and it was well organized.
Mm-hmm.
We were learning, but in addition to that, we were well trained when it came to moving troops and things of that nature. When they decided to take us out of college, they sent us to various outfits, and I was going to say lucky. That's not really the best word for it. I was sent to Hunter Leggett Military Reservation, and they had a couple of divisions there that were fighting each other.
Some maneuvers down there?
Maneuvers down there to teach them how to do this and that. They decided that our group of guys were to go into the 89th Division. This was a division that had been in maneuvers there for some time. And, of course, they had all of their buddies and all the rest of it. And here we college boys come in, and they hated our guts, just absolutely hated our guts. And these fellows were from New Orleans for the most part. And I don't think all of them could speak English. And here these college boys come in. They can't be any good at anything other than school. So let's treat them like crap. And that's what they did.
So when you headed overseas, were you anxious to get into it? Were you wishing you didn't have to go? Somewhere in between?
Probably say somewhere in between. We had a little concern about our brother and how good they would be, and they disliked us to a point that we sort of stuck to ourselves, and that didn't make them too happy.
And when you say we, you mean the guys who had come from the ASTP program, the college guys, were kind of alienated by the people who'd been in that division for a while.
Correct.
So you had some real big factions here, and you weren't quite sure that those guys would have your back on the battlefield? Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, that's part of it. But they didn't ship us right away. We were sent to the East Coast and were on maneuvers there. And that's when they actually gave us assignment. And I ended up being in headquarters and given the job of a scout.
So you're part of the reconnaissance platoon.
I was part of a reconnaissance platoon.
Did you know what that was going
to
mean?
They gave us the prospects. What's happened to them when they've been in combat? Guys that were scouts, what kind of life did they have? I found out that my job, you expect to live 15 minutes on the average, which shakes you up a little bit.
So they're saying if you are out there as a scout and you survive more than 15 minutes in combat situations and actual engaging the enemy, that you're beating the odds.
Right.
That's not very encouraging.
No, it's not. I don't want to get ahead of the story, but when we arrived in France, they started taking the unloading, what have you, and what do you know? We didn't get any of our tanks over. We didn't get any of our guns. We got our guys, all the guys, but without a machine gun, without a cannon, without a tank, without a bit of artillery, that discouraged the hell out of us because it was cold and raining and wet.
This was early 1945?
Yeah, and here we are in tents that we did have tents to keep the water off of us, which was pretty good. But if you can't find something to eat, it's a little bit tough. So they were able to drag a little bit of food in. Of course, being the way the college boys and the hillbillies, you couldn't guess who would get fed first. And none of us got very much when it went on. And without any guns, it's pretty discouraging. So the guys that were making the decisions said, well, you know, we got a problem. Out of the beaches are mined, our guys had mined them, and the Germans had mined them, and we need to clean up those minefields so that we can get tanks and other equipment available to you guys, to the division. So they said, well, that's a good job for you guys, that college boys. Let's put the college boys on it. And so we had minefields are not a very happy place to be, and the Germans, when they set their minefields, they would start with a couple of four or five teller mines, and then they'd pyramid them on up to so the top one, which might be 6 to 8 to 10 feet, would be just a single mine, so that if you tripped it, then it would trip a whole raft of them. So we had no mining detectors or anything of that nature.
Yeah, you did. Didn't you have a bayonet?
Well, that's what it turned out to be. We had to use bayonets to find the mines. Everything's tied together. So if you go off one mine, you're going to ship a whole 50 or 100 or 1,000 of them in time.
I can't imagine what that's like, because you look out and you have no idea where the mines are.
That's
right. And you have to walk out on it knowing that one of these could blow you sky high at any moment.
And blow up some of our guys, too.
Yeah, so it's not just your life in your hands, it's a bunch of other guys.
Yeah.
How did you handle that?
Very carefully, I'll tell you.
You tiptoeing? How do you navigate your way?
We had bayonets, and we worked up teams, trained them real well, tested them and what have you, so that we knew who were top guys that had good sense. Of course, we were all college guys. None of the other boys wanted to do the job. So we did the job, cleared all the mines.
And how do you do that when you say you've got a bayonet? So you're putting it in the ground gingerly and trying to feel around, or
what? That's right. You're putting it in, and you'll hear it tink. And then when you hear it, well, then you have to carefully clear the area so that you find out whether the mine is mined. Because they wanted to sucker you into the situation.
What do you do with them once you find them?
Very carefully. We had a little dynamite that they allowed us, and we very carefully would lay out a field when we'd set off the target.
So you would find them all, then strategically place dynamite to blow them up, disable them.
Right. Whatever we could do to open the field so that they could land more tanks, more other equipment. It took us quite a little while. My guys were so careful that we did it without an accident.
That's impressive.
It was impressive. Well, we were probably working for at least 10 to 20 days on the thing, and then some German prisoners came in. Our guys had captured them, and were putting them down, and I suggested to our guy that was making the decisions that we put these chaps to work. Their mines, they're the German mines, they're set by the Germans, and they should know more about that thing than us college boys, and we convinced the guys to let the Germans do the job.
And we'll understand the sobering reality of how that worked out when we come back from our first break. We're also going to hear about the morning of April 4th, 1945, when Ralph and his squad discovered the Ohrdruf concentration camp. And he'll share the incredibly weighty decision that he was forced to make. You can find photos of Ralph then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And we'll be right back after this.